Purposes BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0, Germany's Economics Podcast with Daniel Stetter.
Hello and a warm welcome to my podcast. My name is Daniel Stelter and I'm publishing a weekly podcast in Germany on economic issues. From time to time, I produce an English version when I have discussion partners who speak English, like today, where William White is my guest. I will discuss with William White about the consequences of the Nixon shock 50 years ago.
I am determined that the American dollar must never again be a hostage in the hands of international speculators.
50 years ago, the then US President Richard Nixon decided that the USA would, with immediate effect, stop to fulfill its obligations to meet dollar demands of the other central banks in gold upon request.
We must protect the position of the American dollar as a pillar of monetary stability around the world. In the past 7 years, there's been an average of one international monetary crisis every year. Now, who gains from these crises? Not the working man, not the investor, not the real producers of wealth. The gainers are the international money speculators. I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and in the best interest of the United States.
The bond to gold, which was only very loose in any case, was thus at an end. Since then, the worldwide monetary system has no anchor. And in this episode, we try to qualify what have been the consequences of this decision and what we should expect for the future.
William Bill White studied at the University of Windsor from 1969 to 1972. He worked as an economist at the Bank of England. He then went to the Canadian Central Bank for 22 years. In 1994, he moved to the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, the Bank of Central Banks, so to speak. In August 23, William White had personally expressed his concerns to then Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan about his monetary policy, but he was not listened to. A few years later, the global financial crisis confirmed his calculations, fears, and warnings. In October 29, White became head of the Economic and Development Review Committee at the OECD. Since then, he has advised the German Chancellor at the G20 meetings, among others.
Dear Bill, thank you very much again for joining me in my podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I enjoyed it last time, and I'm sure I'll enjoy it this time, too.
Do you remember where you have been when Nixon announced that the United States will not anymore hand out gold to their creditors?
You know, I think I had just left my job at the Bank of England. I'd been there for 3 years, and I was on my way back to Canada. To be honest, I don't actually remember the momentous decision, perhaps because there was so much going on in my personal life. But I do remember when I left the Bank of England having an interview with Kit McMahon, who was then the deputy governor. And he was a shadow of his normal self because he was in charge of sort of the foreign exchange side, and the pound had been under tremendous pressure. And it was, in a certain sense, almost the introduction of a new world with all of the capital flows, and they were totally unprepared for it. And of course, when you think about everything that's happened since, capital flows have been a big chunk of the kind of problems that the international monetary system has been subject to.
Well, we come to the problems, but looking back, was it a surprise? Well, no, officially, people, if you now read you know, articles about it, it basically says, okay, it was not a surprise. It was expected somehow. But was it, or would you say it was a surprise at the time being? Or was it really, you know, it was just a question of when, but not if?
Yeah, I think when you sort of look back at that time, there was a certain inevitability about it. I mean, the Bretton Woods system was set up the way that it was set up, you know, with the dollar exchange system into gold. So it was, you know, in the aftermath of the Second World War. So it seemed like a logical way to proceed. But of course, as the years wore on, and as the number of dollars sort of outside the system grew and grew, the ratio of gold to dollars just got less and less. And so I think the Americans could see the writing on the wall. I mean, the Germans, the British had already come to them sort of saying they wanted cover for some of their holdings. I can't remember all this clearly, but I think the French set a battleship to pick up their gold at the New York Fed. Germans were, you know, were pretty unhappy about what was going on. And the fundamental problem was that if people had come in and asked for conversion of their dollar balances into gold, the states knew that they couldn't do it. And so better to preempt this problem and sort of, in a sense, give the indication of being in control than to let the whole thing unfold in a disorderly way. So in a way, it was the transformation of the global economy between the end of the war in 1972, not least which was the growing that basically doomed the system. So, I mean, I could talk, I guess, you know, one might talk about, could the system have been saved? Well, there are some people who do think the system could have been saved if foreigners, non-US people, had been willing to accept a much higher price for gold.
Basically, coming back to your point, you said basically we had an expansion of the monetary base in the United States, which was much too fast. And we had, at the same time, we had the rebalancing of the world economy with Germany and Japan, for example, getting a much, much higher share of the world economy after the Second World War. So you said, could the system be saved? Well, it could have been saved by Germany and the others accepting, you know, a devaluation of the US dollar and devaluation of their receivables in US dollar. But wasn't it the problem that basically Nixon, like many other politicians, he didn't just want to save; he just want to continue spending. So, is a system of a fixed exchange rate? Is it actually possible with politicians? Because politicians always want to spend more than they get as tax revenues.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, when you think about the context, but I think this is more to do with the timing, okay? I think the system, as I said before, was essentially doomed because of the way in which the world was evolving. But in terms of the timing, I mean, there's absolutely no question that Nixon was preoccupied with getting reelected. And I mean, we know the kind of pressure that, or at least I think we know the kind of pressure that he put on Arthur Burns, who is then the chairman of the Fed, to sort of keep things easy in order to support his reelection hopes. So he didn't have the political will to do the kind of tightening up or to encourage the kind of tightening up in the states that might have been required. So yeah, you're right. In the end, it does come down to a question of political will to do certain things. And maintaining a fixed exchange rate takes a lot of discipline and the willingness to do some hard things, you know, like raising interest rates when it's not convenient. But you have to raise them because your currency is under pressure. Well, politically, it's much easier to simply say, well, just let it slide.
So Nixon went off the gold standard. Actually, was it really, as you always say, it was a gold standard? Was it actually a gold standard? It was a dollar standard, huh? with a theoretical link to gold.
Yeah, the dollar, it was called, the dollar exchange standard. But you know that the funny thing though is that when you look back at earlier systems, I mean, the even in the heyday of the gold standard, or even sort of during the interwar period, you know, we look upon it as gold was at the center of the system, but in fact, it was also a gold exchange system in the sense that there were an awful lot of people that were using for the reserves sterling and increasingly the dollar. And Hayek, in his writings at the time, used to sort of worry about the fact that you had these sort of national currencies, as it were, creeping into the international monetary order in a way that he thought was making it harder to, as it were, govern the system.
So, but now, but Bretton Woods was dead. And if you now look back the last 50 years, and we have seen developments, and as we just discussed already in our last discussion, we have seen a significant increase in debt, public debt and private debt, absolute and relative to GDP. We have seen more and more active central banks lowering interest rates, fighting any kind of financial crisis, fighting any kind of recession. All this would not have been possible in the Bretton Woods system. But would you say that what was, in your view, was the Bretton, was Nixon or to blame, or was the end of the Bretton Woods system to blame for the upcoming inflation? Was it to blame for the financialization of the world? Or do you say, no, it was just the first step in a certain direction, but it was not possible to envisage where we might end up 50 years later?
Well, it certainly wasn't possible to envisage it with any precision. But I guess, you know, as I think back about questions having to do with fixed exchange rate systems as opposed to floating exchange rate systems, they have their pros and cons, each of them. And, you know, it's interesting to see the way that people flip-flop back between them. I mean, in Canada, we've done this for decades. But the sort of floating gives you much more flexibility and, you know, the capacity to respond to shocks, external shocks through exchange rate movements, in principle, both up and down. It does give you more flexibility, and that's one of the big advantages of a floating exchange rate system. The thing about a fixed exchange rate system is that it provides a lot of discipline, that, you know, there's certain things you have to do because there's a rule set down that basically has to be followed. And so there's a trade-off there between flexibility and discipline. And of course, Bretton Woods was, as I understand it, was set up in a way that tried to get the best of both worlds, in that it was essentially a fixed rate system, but under duress, and if you could prove to the IMF that there was good cause, then you could depreciate. But as I say, the whole thing came unstuck at the time of Bretton Woods. And so we were left essentially with a floating rate system. And I think a lot of people, you remember Milton Friedman in the early days, the Chicago School, really espoused all of the advantages of floating. But what they didn't sort of factor in was that the flexibility given by floating would be biased by political imperatives to constantly taking the easy way out, which is that depreciation became much more the chosen alternative as opposed to appreciation. And as I look back on it, I mean, I guess what I'd say is, the fundamental problem that we've got is that the dollar is still at the heart of the international financial system. So it's still essentially a dollar-based system. That's the first point. The second point is that I think, as a totally personal perspective, is that monetary policy in the United States has not been conducted well, and that the easy solution of sort of print the money, an asymmetric willingness to lower interest rates as opposed to raise them, has put them on a rather bad path, leading to excessive credit growth and debt growth and all the rest of it. That's the second point. So first point, the U.S. is at the core. Second point, they've not managed their own affairs very well. But the third point is that everybody else has gone along with them in the following sense, that when the U.S. was conducting relatively easy monetary policies, and that meant that their currency, the dollar, ought to have gone down, everybody else was basically saying, well, it's sort of inconvenient for us to have our currencies go up, and so we're going to resist it by following more or less the same kind of monetary policies that you're following. And so, in a way, they've been complicit in the bad management of the international financial system. And so, in the end, what we've wound up with, I mean, as you're well aware, is a system where everybody, basically all of the big guys, have been conducting policies that have led their interest rates down to zero, that have led to their central banks having massive expansion of their balance sheets, and generally have not only contributed to the crises that we've seen up until now, but have left us in a situation where it is entirely possible that future crises might also still happen. So I see the problems that we've faced over the course of the last, 72, 30, 50 years, really as having a number of different components. And to me, I guess it leads you to the conclusion that it's not a good idea to have an international currency basically based on national currencies, that it just invites too much bad behavior.
But Bill, just before we come probably to a solution, I just try to summarize what I understood from you in my words, and if I'm wrong, I know you will correct me, and that's good. So I would, to put it bluntly, say the following. After the Second World War, or at the end of the Second World War, we came up, basically the Allies, mainly the US, came up with a fixed exchange rate system called Bretton Woods, which was where everyone was anchored towards the dollar, because the US was seen as a superpower and the economic strongman. Then the US didn't play the role they should have played, because they basically at the time being already had too much money growth, and they started social programs. They had war in Vietnam, and this led to an expansion far above the normal growth rate of the dollar base. At the same time, the countries like Japan, Germany, others, you know, gained relative share in the world economy, and this led to the fact that Bretton Woods system was uncomfortable for the U.S. It got more and more uncomfortable for the U.S. because they were limited, because, as you said, you know, in a fixed rate exchange system, you cannot do whatever you like, but have certain limitations. So basically, the Nixon shock ended Bretton Woods. But, and now that's what my understanding what you said, implicitly, we had a continuation of Bretton Woods without the formal rules, but by complicit behavior. So as the US continued bad economic policies, expanding monetary base, lowering interest rates, devaluing, everyone else tried to have an implicit peg to the dollar. And therefore, we have a Bretton Woods system still, secretly, and we still have the world currency and the managers of the world currency not behaving in the global interest, but just for the US interest. Is this now exaggerating, or is this basically what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that's basically what I'm saying. And ultimately, it goes back to, I think, something I said just a moment ago, is that it's not a good idea to have a national currency at the heart of the international monetary system, because the national currency will be its value and its movements will be determined by what is good for the economy, people, society, call it what you will, of the nation that owns the currency. And when you talk to people in the States about this particular issue, I mean, they will point out they're not behaving wickedly. You know, the Federal Reserve, for example, follows national objectives having to do with price stability and full employment, because there is legislation that says they have no choice but to do that. So in a sense, it would be sort of nice to sort of, you know, rail against the individual sort of led to the kind of outcomes that we've seen. But in a way, they're just following the legislation that they must follow. The fundamental problem is the problem of the system. And that's what we have to start thinking more seriously about. But there doesn't seem to be much of an appetite for doing so. And I suspect one of the reasons is that in the same sort of way as easy monetary conditions in the United States lead on to higher asset prices and increased riches for those that hold those assets, by pegging to the dollar in a quasi-fixed way and importing those same conditions elsewhere, for lots of people, that seems like a pretty good idea, because it's quite comfortable to watch the value of your assets going up. Even if in some fundamental sense, that increase in values is actually quite illusory. But it's the system I think we need to think about. And unfortunately, at the moment, there doesn't seem to be much inclination to want to do so.
Yeah, because, you know, look, the US is a big beneficiary of the system, as far as I understand it. I've seen the statistics that in spite of running trade deficits for decades, the US still holds lots of foreign assets. Why? Because they pay the imports with their own currency and they continue to devalue it over time. So it's a good business model for the US. At the same time, as currently still the uncontested superpower, it's perceived as being a safe haven for many people. Therefore, they've got a privilege with their currency, and so why should they give it up?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's going to be no, unilateral move coming out of the United States to do so until they start to realize the downsides of the policies that they've been following. Or that not just the policy that they've been following. As I said before, you know, there's in a sense there's nothing wrong with the United States devaluing as long as people will let them. But in a fundamental way, the problem has been that other people have not allowed them to do so. And so the upshot, as years have gone by, is that the U.S. net liabilities abroad have grown greater and greater. Although, as you say, rightly say, as long as people are prepared to put up with the devaluation of the U.S. dollar and still continue to invest in U.S. dollars, I guess what we see will continue. Now, the question at the end is, will there be finally a recognition that the tolerable losses on an ongoing basis from the depreciation of the U.S. dollar are acceptable? Will there be a change from that to a feeling that this is going to get much worse and we better get out while we can? That's really the big question going forward. You know, the question of, will there be a dollar crisis at some point? that will lead to an appetite to discuss some other way of running the international monetary system.
But I think you mean a Biden shock, no? You mean basically after 50 years after Nixon shock, a Biden, whoever might be the next president, shock, because then the trust is even more eroded than it was 50 years ago. And that's basically then people are not going to accept the dollar anymore, because I think that would be what you talk about if there's another crisis. It would be a fundamental crisis of trust in the world currency.
Yes. I mean, that would be the worry. That would be the worry. Now, having said that, I mean, you know, and I know that we've had almost 50 years of people saying that the current system is unsustainable and it will stop. I mean, think about Triffin, for example, back in, what was it, 1956?
Robert Triffin, a Yale professor, sat in front of Congress Joint Economic Committee and calmly announced that the Bretton Woods system was doomed. His rationale, by agreeing to have its currency used as a reserve currency, a country pins its hands behind its back. To keep the global economy chugging along, it may have to inject large amounts of currency into circulation, driving up inflation at home. The more popular the reserve currency is relative to other currencies, the higher its exchange rate and the less competitive domestic exporting industries become. This causes a trade deficit for the currency-issuing country, but makes the world happy. If the reserve currency country instead decides to focus on domestic monetary policy by not issuing more currency, then the world becomes unhappy. This is now known as Triffin's dilemma.
Basically said, the system is unstable and it will come unstuck. Well, that was 50 years ago. And increasingly, people are saying, oh, yes, there's a problem there, and it's becoming a deeper and deeper problem. But every crisis, think back to 2008, 2009, there were a lot of people. I remember Nouriel Roubini, I was on a panel with him, and lots of people were basically saying, we've come to the end of the line, there'll be a dollar crisis when the crisis occurs, it'll take the dollar down with it. The very opposite happened. The crisis occurred, it had its heart in the United States, and regardless, the dollar strengthened significantly as opposed to weakening. So for all of the concerns, we thus far have not really seen the crisis is not unfolded in the way that many people thought it might.
So why? Because until 50 years ago, people who basically gave a credit in dollar had the hope it's somehow backed by gold. Then it was stopped to be backed by gold, but it's still backed by the world's leading superpower. I think that's still the fact. So, and for the Americans, it was, of course, easier because it's basically led to the fact they had to have no more limits on the creation of dollars, which they had before, given the gold reserves. So it's always based on arms, basically, on weapons, on military strengths. And this is basically the world we live in. So if you would say, okay, there might be a crisis, this crisis could only be possible, in my view, then if they lose the status of world economic power and superpower as a military wise, I would assume.
I mean, you're spot on in saying the fundamental issue is the issue of credibility. Do you have confidence, finally, that things will not be allowed to sort of get out of hand somehow? Does the monetary authority in the issuing currency have credibility? And up until now, a significant degree of credibility has been maintained. Now, where does the credibility come from? I think you're right in suggesting it's not just what has been done with respect to the purchasing power of the currency itself. I think a U.S. dollar today is, a U.S. dollar in 1907, I think, would buy you 3 cents today. So that's not the only thing that's at play here. Of course, you could say the same thing about other central banks as well. But it's the broader context of, you know, is the U.S. A hegemon? Is it the sort of the place where you'd go when things got really rough? And Yeah, and I think all of that stuff is there. Is it being eaten away? Yeah, in part it is being eaten away, not least of which is because other countries, and not just advanced countries, you know, Europe is coming together. I mean, at least relative to where it was prior to the euro, the rise of China, some of the other emerging markets, all of this stuff is sort of, you know, gradually sort of making the role of the hegemon less secure, but still it's still there at the center. And from the look of it, it's not likely to go away soon. Now, having said that, I guess, you know, there's so many concerns that people do have about the polarization in the United States and some of the stuff that's been going on there, the elections and whatever. There's a new cause for concern about the credibility of the hegemon, but we're not there yet.
You mentioned the euro, and actually, isn't the euro something similar like Bretton Woods, because it's a fixed exchange rate system down to earth? If you really look into it, it's a currency union, but basically it's a fixed exchange rate system. Is it a correct assessment that it's like Bretton Woods, or would you say no, the euro is different?
No, I think you're right. What's sort of interesting is the way that at the global level, I think because of the capital flows, the ease of capital flows are sort of at the heart of this conundrum. But at the global level, of course, people moved on to floating. You know, the big currencies sort of float against each other, the euro against the dollar, the yen, et cetera, et cetera. But within Europe, the decision was taken to go in the very opposite direction, to basically have a single currency. And that decision, I guess, was sort of premised on the idea, maybe as with Bretton Woods, that the center, you know, would be a reliable custodian of the currency's future, that the central bank would act in a reasonable way to maintain price stability, the external value of the currency, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, even within Europe, I mean, as you're well aware, there have been all sorts of problems that have threatened the integrity of the euro. So fixed exchange rate systems, currency unions, are not so easy to maintain. And as a German, you know that better than I do.
Unfortunately, yes. But what would be the learning from Bretton Woods for the euro?
Well, one of the things that you should recognize is that dangers can emerge from various sources. So one of the things that struck me in the early days of the euro crisis, or prior to the European crisis, was the sense that current accounts didn't matter anymore. Current account imbalances didn't matter anymore because the exchange rates were permanently fixed. But what people forgot about was that you could get rid of currency risk, but you didn't get rid of counterparty risk. And it was the big trade imbalances that were building up and the changes in competitiveness within the eurozone that in the end sort of led to big problems. So there's various ways in which things can come unstuck. I think it's also important that there be some kind of discipline at the center. And so in that sense, I have over the course of the years actually been pretty supportive of the sort of German European way of doing things, of being more concerned about fiscal discipline, more concerned about exchange rate discipline. Having said that, you can also go too far down that road. And I think during the course of the European crisis that one could say the Europeans did go too far down that road. So you have different systems and they have different exposures. And you have to have an open mind about what those exposures might be.
But as we speak about exposures, you spoke about imbalances. We have one imbalance, which is heavily discussed in Germany, which are the so-called target two receivables from the Bundesbank. You know that the Bundesbank currently has, I think, approximately 1.2 trillion in receivables, and the Italians, the Spanish, the French are the main debtors.
Yeah.
And so my question would be, if you now think about Bretton Woods, in Bretton Woods, there was also an imbalance because the French, the British and the Germans, they had huge receivables, basically claims on the US dollar. And some were already asking to have these claims converted into gold. Is there some similarity between target two receivables and the imbalances at the time of Bretton Woods?
The ultimate problem that you get into here is it's the capital flows. Okay, and what you're seeing in the target two is the capacity for people in the peripheral countries to take their deposits and transfer them basically into Deutschmarks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they've done.
Not into Deutschmarks, but into German assets.
Into German assets. Okay, I just use that as a what's the word? A word for it. And I guess the worry that we would have under the current system is that you would have the same kind of thing, that you'd get a run on the US dollar. And then the question is, now that I think about it, this is what's going on, is that the central banks in the non-US countries are basically sort of leaning against the appreciation by buying those dollars and selling their own currencies. So the reserves, in a sense, that are being held, and there's been a massive buildup of international reserves, those reserves are the equivalent of the target two assets held by the Bundesbank. It's essentially the same thing.
It's a mechanism of stabilizing exchange rates. So it's a mechanism of stabilizing the euro.
Yeah, it's the same thing, but again, it's a difference between market risk and counterparty risk. In the case of Germany, the real worry is that one of those countries will say, "You thought you had an asset? You don't, because I'm not going to pay." You know, and I withdraw from the euro, and that's an end on it. And so all of a sudden, you've got something that's worth nothing. Counterparty risk. Same sort of thing, really, as people were worried about at the beginning of the crisis. And then in the States, it's a somewhat different thing, because the risk is everybody's been stabilizing their currency against the dollar, okay, by buying more and more dollars. But this is what Larry Summers once called the balance of financial terror, okay? You're buying all of those dollars in order to stabilize the currency value, which implies that you're not losing money on an ongoing basis as your currency goes up, okay? Because you're buying the dollars to stop it from going up. But now you've got so many more dollars that if your currency does go up, you've got a really big problem. So this is what he called the balance of financial terror. That's one of the reasons why people do intervene to prevent their currencies from going up. Like I say, the Europeans and the Japanese are complicit in what the international financial system has produced, because they've been doing this to stabilize their currencies against the dollar. And they've done it for a variety of reasons, one of which is they don't want to lose competitiveness. Okay, so we all maintain the status quo, but at the expense of more and more credit and debt creation, which in the end will come back and haunt us all. But the other reason why they do it, not the only other reason, but one other reason why they do it, is that they want to safeguard the value in their own currency of the assets that they hold in dollars. But that comes with its own problems as well, as I've just described.
And what is, in your view, necessary to stabilize the euro to put the euro on a solid footing so that we don't have the risk going forward anymore?
I guess I've thought for some period of time that the euro suffers from what Nicolas Véran calls it, there's an analytical deficit, there's an executive deficit, and there's a democratic deficit in Europe. And I've sort of rephrased that as Europe has got a should problem, a could problem, and a would problem. So the question at issue really is, at the analytical level, does Europe still hold certain false beliefs that it ought not to believe? And I wrote a big paper here about 5 years ago in which I sort of outlined, I think, 8 or 10 of them, that people believe stuff that just isn't true and that ought to change. Second thing is the executive deficit and the question of the power structure. And, things like needing unanimity for many decisions within the EU and within the Eurozone. Is that a good idea? And then there's a demographic deficit, democratic deficit. And what I mean by that is that people in the street still have the sense that they want to do things that are only good for their own national objectives, as opposed to doing things that are good for the supranational objective, because in the end, the supranational construct is beneficial to them at the national level. But they don't see that. Okay, and so they're doing things on a purely sort of national basis. So when you say to people, what Europe really needs is more Europe, more sort of fiscal union, more political union, banking union, economic union, to hold the whole thing together. The response on the part of many is, more Europe? We never asked for any Europe. And that's sort of really unfortunate, because in the end, everything does come down to politics. And if you don't have the people prepared to back the politicians in doing whatever they think it is appropriate to do, then in the end, it's not going to function. So I think Europe should focus more, as it's trying to do. I mean, I've no doubt about that. But there continue to be these, what Nicolas Véran calls deficits, analytical, executive, and democratic.
Yeah, but Bill, just one point here. We have a very different fiscal and monetary policy. Well, monetary not because it's unified, but in the end, it's fiscal is also monetary, because if you have more debt, you create more money, according to MMT, and I think this part of MMT is true. And we have a divergence here in Europe. And now they have, after the corona crisis, they have now come up with this reconstruction fund, and they take on our debt on a European level. So what they're doing is fighting a problem and a crisis which was caused by too much debt with more debt.
Well, my sense, Daniel, is that we're in a bad place, and that all of the alternatives are bad, but some of them are better than others. And when I think about sort of the need for maintaining aggregate demand in the current circumstances, my sense of it is that there's more room at the fiscal level than there is at the monetary level. And that when you think about sort of monetary expansion, I think the credibility of the ECB and of the Eurozone as a whole probably is greater than at the level of the individual countries. So I think about what they did in the Reconstruction Fund and the willingness to issue bonds that for which the union will be jointly liable is better than the alternatives. And I do not wish to deny the downside of it. It's like more broadly, you know, around the world, but particularly in the G10 countries, we've had the fiscal authorities increase government spending in an extraordinary fashion relative to what they did in 2008 and 2009. Earlier on, we've relied almost entirely on monetary policy. And I guess my sense is I don't want to see any more debt. But we have to have more debt to keep the system going. And the question is, what's more palatable approach? Still more private debt, you know, incurred through easy money and all sorts of weird and wonderful ways to expand the balance sheet, or perhaps more fiscal, allied with what I hope would be a credible promise to start to get the monetary thing under control sooner rather than later. Now, I have not thus far seen as clear a statement as I would like on the part of anybody, any of the authorities, about the need to renormalize policy in the future to provide a kind of credible anchor to what's going on at the moment. I would really like to see that. Like MMT basically seems to say, well, you can spend as much as you want and then you can print it, and as long as there's no inflation, there's no problem. I totally disagree with that. I think this is the least bad of the things that we can do under the circumstances, but we should already be taking steps to say to people, this is not going to be a permanent state of affairs. We're going to get the government deficits under control and the government debt. We're going to get the monetary and credit aggregates under control. But unfortunately, it's going to have to be tomorrow, not today. Because today we've got ourselves into a real problem. So that's sort of how I see it. There's a line I may have used on you before from John Kenneth Galbraith, where he said, politics is not the art of the possible. It is choosing between the unpalatable and the disastrous. And I think what people are doing at the moment is unpalatable. You know, the increase in public sector debt. It's unpalatable, but it's better than the alternative, which is disastrous. Now, having said that, as I've just said, we should be seeing through this and saying this is a temporary measure. We are determined to sort this out over time. And I don't see that message coming through anywhere near as clearly as I would like.
Yeah, but basically what you're saying is, we have a system in which credit growth is required, because when a central bank is intervening to stabilize its own currency against the US dollar, basically it means it buys US dollar
and sells buying it and creates its own.
It creates its own money, and basically the monetary base in the country goes up. And this basically leads then to either inflation, or in our today's world, as we have a more of a deflationary setup, it leads to asset price increases and to bubbles, et cetera, et cetera. So we are in a world where we have an incentive for many parties, for many countries, for many politicians to have a continuous credit growth, which goes beyond what's needed for the real economy.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. And it's not just that the Americans have behaved badly. It's that the system, that in a certain sense, everybody has been able to behave badly because the system allows them to do so.
The current system, as we describe it, it's actually very similar to Bretton Woods. Just we don't have the link to gold anymore. The link to gold 50 years back really a break on credit growth, or was it more of a theoretical break?
I think it was more of a theoretical break, I think. But I wouldn't say I'm enough of a student of the the period to say that that was so. But I do know, I can't remember Hayek's book that he wrote, I think, in, it was a series of lectures that he wrote for the League of Nations in 1938. And he makes a very clear distinction between the way the gold standard was supposed to work and the way in which the gold exchange standard did actually work. So the question was gold a constraint? Well, I guess it was a constraint, but perhaps not as great a constraint as you might have thought, that we were already inventing ways to sort of get around it. So in the end, I must say that I'm getting drawn more and more to issues like narrow money. You know, whether in fact the fundamental problem is not is the fundamental problem is that we have fiat currency systems essentially everywhere, and have done for a very, very long period of time. And these fiat currency systems have the nature of the systems that we've just been describing, which is that they do tend to create these booms and busts and secular increases in credit and debt that cause all sorts of problems. And that one possible answer is to go back to what the Chicago School used to call narrow money, which is that you just draw a line between money and stuff that isn't money. And at the moment, there is no clear distinction.
Just to make it clear to our audience, so basically you say narrow money is the money created by the central bank, and all other money is created by banks, which is actually credit. So if you go to a bank and get a loan to finance your apartment, the bank is creating money, and we know that probably 90% of the money we are using is created by banks, and only 10% is created by central banks. That's basically what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's basically what it comes down to. And so what you're saying is that The money that's created by the banks, okay, it will no longer be possible for them to do that. That instead of when you go to your bank at the moment, you know, you go in and you get a loan, and they basically say, well, here's the money we deposit in your account. So their bank's liabilities go up, and at the same time, they credit on the books an asset, because you owe them the money. So in that fashion, they're creating money as they go, constrained only by reserve requirements and, you know, and the availability of central bank money, a fractional banking system, as they call it. Well, under a narrow banking system, anything that was classified as money would be have to, you know, so any current account that you could take out would have to be backed up 100% by some government liability, base money with the central bank, or alternatively government securities of some sort, but a place where there'd be absolutely no counterparty risk and no liquidity risk either. So that would significantly curtail the subsidy that is effectively being given to the private sector now by the public sector, because the public sector has, for reasons going back, 400 or 500 years, the public sector, which basically has the right to create money, has given that right to the private sector. And one might well ask, in a time when governments are, you know, are looking around for finances to finance their own legitimate objectives, whether in fact that subsidy might not be reduced. And when you think about central bank digital currency, I have thought about this. I'm not sure whether it's a widely spread thought, but that one of the worries that people have about central bank digital currency is that if people both hold current accounts with the banks, the commercial banks, and have a deposit with the central bank, that in times of stress, that will be inclined to take the money out of the commercial bank and stick it into the central bank. And this will cause all sorts of liquidity problems that we'll have to respond to, et cetera, et cetera. Well, one simple answer is to simply say, well, we just simply won't let people do that anymore. That commercial banks can only offer deposits that look as safe as central bank money if they are as safe as central bank money. Narrow banking. So it gets more complicated than that because you have to get into the eternal question of people creating stuff that looks like money, you know, like the money market mutual funds and all that range of territory. But one is inclined to think that with the technological advances we have at the moment, that maybe it might be possible to distinguish more clearly between stuff that's really money, that is to say that has its base in the central bank, as opposed to stuff that isn't money. And we sort of, at the moment in previous decades, we've sort of pretended that stuff that isn't really money can look like money because we allow people to exchange current account money for notes. Well, maybe it's time to do things differently. I'm not saying I recommend this. All I'm saying is that it seems to me as the crises associated with the current system become ever more evident that we should be pushed in the direction of thinking about alternative ways to do it. And that implies not only alternative ways to run the national monetary system, but it also raises questions about how we want to run the international monetary system.
Well, now I spoke to Chris Watling from Longview Economics a few weeks back, and he was making similar observation like you. He said basically after 50 years, it's time for a restart of the financial system because he said, well, since Bretton Woods, we've seen a trend of too high debt, basically excessive debt, excessive inequality. And now listening to you, I hear you saying, well, you know, okay, it was a theoretical gold standard, but there was no break because there were ways around it. And I would say, fine, Nixon was basically too lazy to say, I want to look for ways around it. So I just openly say, I don't have any link anymore. And then since then, we have seen waves of deregulation with lower equity requirements, with the financialization of the world. And this was, you said it was a subsidy to the private sector. True. But on the other hand, it was also in the best interest of the politicians who benefited significantly from higher credit growth because it was allowed them to run higher public deficits, but also allowed them to cover up some other issues like wage pressure after China entered the world economy. So it was actually a good ride for many people. And as you also pointed out, that many people look forward for the cheap money also coming out, basically importing it from the US because central banks have to link their currencies to the US dollar as a defense against an appreciation. So without a crisis, why should politicians of the world sit together and say, we change the system?
Yeah, that's precisely right. We should, it seems to me, always be thinking in terms of what are the downsides going forward of what we're doing. But as we all know, and it seems to be baked into mankind through evolution, we're much more focused on solving today's problems than we are thinking about future problems. And indeed, how today's solutions might become tomorrow's problems. So I wish we would do that. I wish we had done that. But we haven't. And so it may well be that it'll take another crisis to prompt that kind of more radical thinking, that it's the system itself that's at fault. It's not bad people, but it's the system itself that has allowed this kind of thing to happen. So, but even there, you know, I mean, it's funny. I would have thought that the great financial crisis, you know, 2008, which all the models said couldn't happen, And if it did happen, you know, it'd sort itself out within a couple of years. I would have thought that the experience of the great financial contraction and the 10 years of slow growth subsequently would have indicated that the system doesn't work the way that the theoreticians say it does work or it should work. It doesn't work that way. And I would have thought that would have got people to start thinking again. But the very opposite has happened. It's been more of the same. And Daniel Kahneman, you know, the Israeli psychologist who won the Nobel Prize, I think, in 2003, he contends that it's actually human nature, that when you believe something and then something happens that really conflicts with your belief system, you don't, in fact, reject the belief system. You hunker down deeper and deeper into the belief system because it's all you've got. And somehow the human mind abhors the idea of an intellectual vacuum. I don't know. It won't go there. And so sometimes even with crises, you don't get the kind of rethink that the crisis really demands. So I don't know. These are, we're getting deeply into psychological issues about which I know even less than economics.
Yeah, no, but the point is, oh, well, you know, I think, look, we agree in the assessment of the problem. And I think I find it very interesting that you are now more in favor of narrow money. I have to look back into our old podcast because I wasn't sure as to whether you were already so supportive for the time being. We know that from the Chicago plan, it's possible to switch the system to narrow money and in doing so, reducing the debt level significantly. And I spoke to Steve Keen. I don't know if you're familiar with Steve Keen, but he.
Oh yeah, I know Steve. I know Steve quite
and
well.
I found an idea very nice, interesting. But he basically was proposing a modern debt jubilee, where he was saying, okay, everyone should get, but let's say $100,000 or €100,000 from the central bank. And if you have debt, you have to use the money to pay back debt. And if you don't have debt, you have to buy shares from companies, yes, which use then this money, yes, to reduce the debt level. So I'm with you that most probably politicians will not be willing to change today. Actually, if you look at the European Central Bank, it looks to me, and the current policy of the Federal Reserve as well, it looks to me more like we continue with full speed the current path. But let's assume we have another crisis, and then having the digital, you know, euro or the digital dollar, and having then something like Steve Keen's proposal of, you know, providing fresh money to everybody in order to deal with debt legacy, I think this could make up for a good start.
Yeah, the thing you have to remember, Daniel, is, you know, this debt jubilee business, this hasn't really been tried since biblical times. And the thing to remember about biblical times is that the debt jubilee was the king and a few of his mates decided that their wealth had grown too great, that it was going to cause social disruption. So they were prepared to do one of these debt jubilees. Today, what we're talking about is pension funds. And the average guy in the street who has financial assets saying to him, you thought they were worth X, well, they're actually only worth half of X. So there's a great illusion there that has to be shattered, and nobody's going to want to do that. So it's all very well to talk about what you should do, but the next question that you get into is what you could do or what you would do. And that's going to be much, much harder to do, because ordinary people are going to find out that they're less well off than they thought they were. And of course, the rich people who intend to be the powerful ones, they're the ones, by virtue of being rich, who will pay the biggest part, play the biggest part in accepting the losses, although the losses will be widespread. They're not going to be very happy about it either.
So it leaves me a bit disappointed now.
It's like that old line of Herb Stein's: if something is unsustainable, it will stop. If debts are not serviceable, they will not be serviced. But the question is whether they will not be serviced in an orderly way or in a disorderly way. And I think all of us would contend an orderly way would be the best way to do it, to recognize reality, bite the bullet, and do it. But my worry is that it's politically so difficult to do that, that there may be a descent into disorderly debt reduction before we get orderly debt reduction.
In another crisis, but actually now 50 years after a speech which has changed, or decision by the US President Nixon, which has changed the monetary order of the world, I learned, well, it was not such a big change because we implicitly continued somehow in this way by protecting each currency, but it has unleashed actually the powers of the financial markets, because the kickoff for many things which followed then has led us into a world where we are prisoners of too high debt levels already, where central banks only know one way, which is lowering interest rates and being pushing more up liquidity whenever crisis hits. And at the same time, a politically, well, not very attractive path for an orderly solution. And therefore, it might well be that in 20 years' time, we can have another podcast than 70 years after Bretton Woods, and you come up with the same arguments like today.
Well, all things are possible. Sadly, I fear that with the concerns that we have about pandemics and in particular climate change, that we will have to start thinking about these things much sooner than 20 years down the line.
So would you, but you know, you could also say that climate change might be an opportunity for a solution, because when we now embark on big spending programs to rebuild our economies, and if these big spending programs are financed by the central banks, so if, as proponents of the modern monetary theory would say, this could lead to higher demand, because this could lead to higher prices. It could clearly lead to a faster growth of nominal GDP. And this could also bring down debt levels relative to GDP, at least.
Absolutely. But the very important proviso is that if the requirements for real investment and spending to deal with climate change, whether it's mitigation or adaptation, are greater than the resources of the economy, and I think modern monetary theory would agree with this too, then you're into a kind of inflationary world, which you have to resist through cutting consumption. And as I sort of look at a new world relative to the one that we've got at the moment, it probably would be a world in which investment levels were higher, because it was necessary to have higher investment to sustain the levels of consumption that people wanted to sustain going forward. And so what that would mean is more sacrifices in consumption short run. So as long as we're prepared to do that, you can see a better world unfolding. But if you have a world in which nobody's prepared to make sacrifices in order to do the investment that is required to deal with climate change and biodiversity and all the rest of it, which we have to confront, if they're not willing to make those sacrifices, then the way in which the resources will be made available will be through inflation. And as you know, and as the German audience knows, that process can all too easily get out of hand.
Which would then be the solution no one wants, because it would be a socially very unfair solution. But in the end, it could also be a solution to too high debt, for too high debt levels.
Oh, yeah.
And it could be the crisis you look for a restart of the system.
Of course, the other thing, and again, I mean, think back to the 1930s, or the 1920s and into the 1930s. You have some combination of inflation, very, very high inflation, rising unemployment, structural damage. That's the kind of environment that invites political dissension. And once that sort of fabric that holds everything together in a democratic way starts to disintegrate, then you're into another whole set of questions. So I'm all for an orderly reduction of the debt overhang as opposed to a disorderly one. And whether it's a deflationary debt deflation or whether it's a very high inflation, both of those things wind up being politically quite disruptive. And I think it would be better to try to avoid them.
And I think that's easy to agree upon. It would be better. My hope is low, to be honest, but I'm with you. It would be better. Dear Bill, thank you very much for your time. I think it was, again, a very interesting conversation with you.
Well, I hope so, Daniel. Sometimes it's easy to start to despair about some of the difficulties that we've gotten ourselves into. But as I tried to stress earlier on, without recommending any new, more radical solution, we should at least be starting to think about what kind of alternative solutions we might think about going forward.
I agree. Thank you very much for tuning in. The next regular edition of this podcast is next Sunday, as usual, in German. All the best, your Daniel Stelter.
BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0.